Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
And from London, England. Good evening in London. It's evening in London, in Leicester Square. And good evening, New Orleans, because for the first time in the years that this broadcast has originated from time to time, and will continue to do so in New Orleans, Louisiana, it's actually being heard over the air with normal radios in New Orleans, Louisiana. So welcome. Welcome. It's been a long time coming. No, don't lose me now. Don't let them do that. Ladies and gentlemen, this is London, England, and there are concerns now about the special relationship, you know, between the United States and the United Kingdom, partly over the release of the alleged, well, the convicted, who am I kidding, Lockerbie bomber, Mr. Al-Megrahi, by the Scottish government, supposedly. And word came out this week that even though the United States was really ticked off, thought they had a deal that would ensure that Megrahi died in prison. Because, you know, the food is better there than in Libya. Apparently, when the consideration of his release began, well, actually, during that whole period, President Obama and Prime Minister Brown haven't spoken since mid-July. That's how good the special relationship is. And then comes word in one of the Sunday papers in England. I believe, I can't remember which, they have so many, that Britain's going to start withdrawing troops from, no, not Iraq, they've done that, Afghanistan, ladies and gentlemen. That's right. We're going to be sending more. They're going to be pulling back because they think the whole thing is something they did before. A special relationship, ladies and gentlemen. You know, if I'm here, I'm in both countries now fairly frequently. I would offer my good offices, you know, to serve as some sort of a go-between. But if I were me, I would withdraw the offer. Ladies and gentlemen, new feature on the broadcast, I think. I think there's legs for this, because we in the United States love being number one. And this came to my mind in the recent weeks of the healthcare debate, when Republican opponents of healthcare reform would constantly say, the United States is number one in healthcare. We've got the best healthcare system in the world. And then their opponents would trot out statistics that said we were 37th in infant mortality and, you know those statistics. So we love to say that we're number one even when we're not, maybe even especially when we're not. So who's number one this week? The United States ranks 28th in the world in the average speed of internet connections. Think of it. And is not making significant progress in building a faster network. And this report is by the Communications Workers of America, who would love to build a faster network, so, you know, we have to take that into account. The average download speed in South Korea is 20.4 megabits per second, four times faster than the U.S. average of 5.1. But the language is so long there. They need that extra time for all, isn't that? Japan trails South Korea with an average of 15.8 megabits per second, followed by Sweden at 12 and the Netherlands at 11. Tests conducted by speedmatters.org found the average U.S. download speed had improved by only 0.9 of a megabit per second between 2008 and 2009. The U.S. has not made significant improvement in the speeds at which residents connect to the Internet, the report said. Our nation continues to fall far behind other countries. People in Japan can upload a high-definition video in 12 minutes compared to a grueling 2.5 hours at the U.S. average upload speed. I don't think it's grueling. You leave and, you know, fix yourself some food or something, don't you? Or watch TV. So we're not number one. Ladies and gentlemen, just keep it in mind. Now it's clean. It's safe. It's too cheap to meter. And where the hell do we put it? A waste depot near the town of Wolfenbüttel in Lower Saxony, Germany, was taken over by the Federal Office for Radiation Protection from the allegedly careless former proprietor Helmholtz Zetrum in January. The agency is currently carrying out an investigation of the waste site and has begun medical tests on former workers. I wonder why that would be. Because it's so safe. A new investigation has revealed that 28 kilograms, you look it up, of radioactive plutonium are stored in the underground shaft depot, three times as much as the Environment Ministry of Lower Saxony previously understood was being stored there. Environment Minister Sigmar Gabriel says it's unbelievable you can get the quantity estimate for such a dangerous substance wrong. Yes, it is. But it's so safe. So who cares, you know? And it's clean and it's cheap. And by the way, Pennsylvania is starting to distribute new iodine tablets to people who work within, live or work within 10 miles of the four or five nuclear plants in Pennsylvania because it's so safe. Ladies and gentlemen, the buried lead department reports in this week. Homeland Secretary Tom Ridge, who went on a I Really Didn't Mean It tour this week as his book came out, because when excerpts first surfaced a couple weeks ago, they seemed to indicate, that is to say, if you read the words, that he was suggesting that at a certain meeting just before the 2004 election, he got the feeling that maybe Rumsfeld, maybe Cheney had political reasons for wanting the threat level raised. And he, as I say, went on a tour this week to say, that's not what I was saying. Why would you think that I... But buried way down in one of the stories about that was this. And if this shouldn't be in the front of a news story, then I'm clean, cheap, safe, and too clean to meet her. Former Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge is dumbfounded that the U.S. government still has no way to track foreign visitors who don't leave the country when their visas expire. Noting, of course, that two of the 9/11 hijackers were in the country on expired visas. But they're dead, so why would you need to follow? And finally, ladies and gentlemen, from the digital wonderland, Jack in Chicago does a follow-up. Kansas City's CBS affiliate did a local news segment this week offering suggestions on how to pick up its digital signal. And it mentioned, of course, in along the way, a special offer from Comcast Cable, in case you couldn't get a station with your antenna. Of course, if you're having reception problems with the digital signal of the station in Kansas City, you couldn't see the local news segment. Good evening, New Orleans, and hello, welcome to the show.
I feel like I'm a king. and I lay down and dream about my people that all live here. We just love her so much. Bop, boop, beep, give me bop, 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 three, these, eh? Bop, bop, three, these, ah. Bop, bop, de, de, bop, 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 these, eh? Boop, boop, beep, boop, beep, beep, bop, bop. Good morning, New Orleans.
Good morning, New Orleans.
We love you, New Orleans.
We love you, New Orleans.
I feel like I'm a king when I lay down and dream about the people that all live here and how we love her so much.
From just across the way from the Thames River. Just a few short steps. From London, England, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen.
A new report says Arctic climate change is happening faster than anyone anticipated and may be soon be forcing more rapid warming on the rest of the planet. It's a tipping point, says Craig Stewart of the World Wildlife Fund, releasing the report here in London. Hey, Craig. The report is an attempt to update the work of scientists involved in the 2007's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as world leaders gather in Copenhagen in December to discuss how to deal with the issue. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. The conclusion of many of those same researchers is that changes are occurring much more quickly, especially in the Arctic, than was believed even 2 years ago. We thought by 2050, multi-year sea ice would be cut in half, says Stewart. It happened in 2007. The biggest worry is so-called methane hydrates, a strange slushy form of methane frozen in ice molecules that exists in vast volumes in permafrost. We discussed this a couple weeks ago, I think. And continental shelves around the circumpolar globe. Thank you. Cold and high pressure have so far kept that methane out of the atmosphere, but underground methane has recently been observed bubbling up in Arctic Russia. Those Russians! Those damn Russians! They can't even keep their methane under control! There's so much methane under the permafrost and under ocean floor sediments that the carbon in that methane is the equivalent of all the coal, oil, and gas combined worldwide. If that methane gets released, that will become the single greatest driver of climate change anywhere in the world. Sea levels are also being increasingly affected by Arctic climate change, as we've discussed on this broadcast in this award-winning segment. And from mid-July to early August 2006, a heat wave swept through the southwestern United States. Temperature records were broken at many locations, and unusually high humidity levels for this typically arid region led to the deaths of more than 600 people, 25,000 cattle, and 70,000 poultry in California alone. I guess it proves it's better to be cattle than poultry. An analysis of this extreme episode carried out by researchers at Scripps Oceanography in San Diego put this heat wave in the context of 6 decades of observed heat waves. Their results suggest that such regional extremes are becoming more and more likely as climate change trends continue. The team, led by climate scientist Alexander Goshunov, examined meteorological conditions that lead to this and other recorded heat waves. They found that heat waves in the region often fall into one of two types, the typical daytime events, dry daytime heat and rejuvenating nighttime cooling, or the less typical nighttime heat waves, high humidity and hot, muggy days and nights. Since the early 90s, nighttime heat wave events in California, historically less common, have become more prevalent and increasing in both in frequency and intensity, the pinnacle occurring in 17-day period during July of 2006. Ugh. Water vapor is the main greenhouse gas during the night in humid environments. Air doesn't cool nearly as much as it does in dry conditions. Elevated humidity also causes heat waves to last longer. Yeah, tell it to the New Orleanians. Hotter nights precondition hotter days, and the cycle feeds on itself until the winds change. The study appeared in the online edition of the American Meteorological Society's Journal of Climate. I didn't get my copy. The kid threw it in the water. Tropical lizards detect the effects of global warming in a climate where the smallest change makes a big difference, according to herpetologist Lori Vitt and George Lynn Cross at the University of Oklahoma's Sam Noble Museum of Natural History. Climate change caused by global warming threatens the very existence of these and other tropical species. According to Vitt, he studied the ecology of lizards and rainforests around the world and for the past 20 years as part of a biodiversity project in the Amazon. He's investigated the effects of global warming on tropical lizards. We depend on these tropical lizards and other species and plant of animals and plants for food, materials, and pharmaceuticals, but we're losing these species as a result. Tropical species are affected more by the very narrow temperature range of their typically warm climate than are ectotherms, thank you, living where the temperatures fluctuate in greater degrees. Even the smallest change in the tropics makes a difference to the tropical species most susceptible. That's right. If you got small change, goes farther in the tropics. Climatic shifts are part of our natural history, but years of research indicate global warming has increased the rate at which climate change is taking place, says Vitt. And this is the one that maybe might want to provoke some thought somewhere along the way, just before we make a move. A report from the highly respected Institute of Mechanical Engineers in the United Kingdom says that without geoengineering, that is to say humans mucking about trying to fix this thing, you know, in technical ways, it will be impossible to combat climate change. It proposes three geoengineering ideas, including a forest of artificial trees to help soak up the world's carbon emissions. The report has a 100-year roadmap to decarbonize the global economy. Well, the roadmap idea worked so well in the Middle East. Why not? The report defines two types of geoengineering. The first category aims to cool the planet by reflecting some of the sunlight away. The second involves the removal and storage of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The team studied hundreds of different options, but put forward just three as being practical and feasible using current technology. Artificial trees are already in the prototype stage. Don't tell the artificial squirrels, and are advanced in their design in terms of their automation and in the components that would be used. According to the report, they could, within a relatively short duration, be moved forward into mass production and deployment. The trees would work on the principle of capturing carbon dioxide from the air through a filter. It would then be removed from the filter and stored. The report calls for the technology to be developed in conjunction with carbon storage infrastructure. Hey, put it right where the plutonium is. That way we'll keep track of it. Because we're so smart. Another proposed methods of capturing carbon is to install algae-based photobioreactors on buildings. These would be transparent containers containing algae that would remove CO2 from the air during photosynthesis. And, of course, the third option, the reduction of incoming solar radiation by reflecting sunlight back into space. Buildings would have reflective roofs. Or we'd put a big sunshade above the atmosphere. Launching the report, though, the authors say geoengineering should not be viewed as the silver bullet that could combat climate change in isolation, but rather as a plutonium bullet. No, they don't say that. All these options, they say, will require more research. So please send them money, won't you? News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it fell to the news fell of the warm fell to the floor, as I was acknowledging that it's a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, because the parade of copyrighted features just does not end, here's news from outside the bubble. What's the world's main heroin dealer? What's the world's main source of heroin? Yes, it's still Afghanistan, according to the UN, and published in Australia, in Australia's broadcasting, ABC. The United Nations report says Afghanistan's problems can't be solved with controlling drugs. It's now commonly believed that corrupt Afghan government officials earn more from the drug trade than does the Taliban. That's right. Our guys make more from the drug trade. The good guys make more from the drug trade than the bad guys. So does that mean the drug trade is good? Afghanistan is the supplier of 90% of the world's heroin. There has been a 10% fall in opium production in Afghanistan in the past year. 800,000 fewer people are involved. That's the good news. But the UN report has more bad news than good. While overall production has fallen slightly, more efficient production methods mean yields per farm are higher. Well, we've taught them something. The destruction of crops has failed as a disincentive, and criminal narco cartels are spreading through Iran, Russia, and Central Asia. Michael Hartman is the head of the criminal division of the UN's Office on Drugs. That's right. He's your brain on drugs at the UN. He says that the last 2 years, which have small reductions, have caused a reevaluation by some countries of whether or not eradication is worth the price being possible increase in support for the Taliban. The biggest reduction in the past year in land under poppies was in Helmand province, where a crop replacement program has the support of the governor. In neighboring Kandahar, poppy cultivation went up by a corresponding amount. Kandahar's governor is the brother of President Karzai. Good night. And now a major story in the Sunday papers in London, actually all week. More on the freeing of the convicted Lockerbie bomber, Mr. Al-Megrahi. First of all, from the Times of London, the furor over the release of the Lockerbie bomber increased this week over the medical advice given to the Scottish government on how long he has to live, because the Scottish Justice Minister based his compassionate release on reports that Mr. Al-Megrahi had but 3 months to live, dying of terminal prostate cancer. It emerged, says the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch, that prognosis was supported by an unnamed doctor who had no expertise in terminal prostate cancer. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. The 3 month time limit is important because Scottish Prison Service guidance says compassionate release may be considered where a prisoner is suffering from a terminal illness and death is likely to occur soon. The life expectancy of less than 3 months may be considered an appropriate period. A specialist, Dr. Andrew Fraser, says whether or not prognosis is more or less than 3 months, no specialist would be willing to say. The unnamed doctor who issued the report saying it would be 3 months is thought to be a general practitioner. Former associate member of the British Association of Urological Surgeons, Dr. Richard Simpson, says the Scottish government has misrepresented the medical evidence. The Justice Secretary chose to disregard the advice of specialists. At the very least, the Justice Minister should have sought a second opinion confirming the patient's prognosis from a specialist in palliative care. That he did not do so showed a disregard for due process. The Scottish government has dismissed the claims. They say the GP was in close consultation with a highly experienced consultant oncologist of many years' experience. And then at the weekend, the story just got a little more interesting because the Sunday Telegraph in London reported today that medical evidence that he was going to live only 3 more months was paid for by the Libyan government. That's what the Sunday Telegraph reports. 2 of the 3 doctors commissioned by the Libyans provided the required 3 month estimates, while the third also indicated the prisoner had a short time to live. This contrasted with the findings of doctors in June and July, who had concluded that Megrahi had up to 10 months to live, which would have prevented his release. Professor Carol Sikora, one of the examining doctors and the medical director of Cancer Partners UK, told the Sunday Telegraph, "The figure of 3 months was suggested as being helpful by the Libyans. To start with, I said it was impossible to do that, give a 3-month life expectancy estimate. But when I looked at it, it looked as though it could be done. You could actually say that." A third doctor would only say he had a short time to live. Megrahi's weekend was moved out of an emergency care unit in Tripoli. Moussa Koussa, I'm sorry, it's the name, a senior Libyan politician who was expelled from Britain in 1980 for boasting of a plot to kill Libyan dissidents in London, played a key role in the talks to free Megrahi and threatened serious consequences if Megrahi died in jail. Koussa is in a position to make that threat. He's now the Libyan foreign minister. And he was once implicated in planning the Lockerbie bombing, a claim he vehemently denies. The Libyans, meanwhile, say that they're concerned that Megrahi be released because the intelligence upon which his conviction was based is no more trustworthy than the intelligence that the U.S. had that said there was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Several business sources have told the Sunday Telegraph Britain was desperate that Megrahi should not die in jail after warnings by Libya last May that if this happened, trade deals between the two countries worth billions of dollars would be canceled. The U.S. government had wanted Megrahi to die in jail. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Who knows? Except we know this. It is copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Welcome to the city where people like to eat. And the music, 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 you can't resist the beat. There's lots of pretty ladies like you've never seen.
I'm Bill Curtis. I was never as big a deal at CBS News as Dan Rather, but now I'm avoiding his slow, sad decline, and I'm doing it on the Internet.
5 minutes, Bill.
Here in my trailer, I'm downloading audition scripts for even more commercials I might do, thanks to this Laptop Connect card. Here on the test track, while they're strapping me into this sports car, I am uploading my highlight reel to my commercial agents. And here on the tennis court, while Andy Roddick gets final touch-ups, I'm touching up my resume, all with the aid of the fastest 3G network ever endorsed by a former newsman. I'm Bill Curtis. I'm flushing away what's left of my credibility, and I'm doing it faster than Dan Rather. On the Internet. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
More from Germany now. A senior figure in German Chancellor Angela Merkel's party faced criticism Friday for comments at an election rally in which he appeared to disparage Romanian workers. That's right, there's still some workers Romanian. Oh, sorry. An amateur video posted on YouTube and aired by several German media outlets showed Jürgen Rüttgers, the governor of North Rhine-Westphalia, saying that unlike employees here in the Ruhr region, those in Romania don't come in for their first shift at 7 in the morning and stay to the end. Instead, they come and go, and they don't know what they're doing. Unquote. Last year, mobile phone maker Nokia closed a factory in Rutgers State, then inaugurated a new plant in Romania, part of an effort to shift jobs to lower-cost locations. Gee, that's new. The decision angered many in Germany. The comments were made in an election rally. Rüttgers, a deputy leader of Merkel's conservative Christian Democrats, later apologized for any hurt caused by his comments.
I was standing behind workers in North Rhine-Westphalia whose outstanding performance is recognized worldwide and who have lost their job because of wrong decisions at company headquarters. I didn't want to insult anyone. If that happened, I'm sorry.
That's an if apology, ladies and gentlemen. Gets marked down, too, for that. Two Bangladeshi newspapers have apologized after publishing an article taken from the satirical U.S. website The Onion. The article claimed the moon landings were faked. They're Bangladeshis. What do you want? The Daily Manab Zaman said U.S. astronaut Neil Armstrong had shocked a news conference by saying he now knew it had been an elaborate hoax. Neither that paper nor The New Nation, which later picked up the story, realized The Onion was not a genuine news site. Both have now apologized to their readers for not checking the story. Another so-called journalism apology, the Hartford Courant's publisher apologized this week for what appears to have been the wholesale plagiarizing by his newspaper of stories, local news stories from other Connecticut papers. Well, they got to. They fired everybody, didn't they? That's how you deal with a downsizing newspaper. You plagiarize. They're angry at us for stealing their news, you know, by reading it for free. So why shouldn't they steal it? Anyway, here's the apology. The Hartford Courant is America's oldest continuously published newspaper, says publisher Richard Graziano. We've been in business for 245 years. We've earned a reputation for integrity, and we take it very seriously. So it's incumbent upon me as a publisher to tell you that we failed to meet our own standards, and as we would with anyone else, we are flagging it, calling it wrong, and taking action. In short, after an extensive internal review, we have determined that over the last several weeks, the Courant plagiarized the work of some of our competitors. This was not our intent. It just happened? No, but it is in fact what happened, yeah. We are taking corrective action to prevent it from happening again. We've also disciplined the individuals involved. This newspaper staff and I are deeply sorry. We apologize to our readers, competitors, and advertisers. Unquote. The instances of plagiarism were numerous and widely noticed by the Courant's competitors. By the way, the paper is owned by the Tribune, I think. And it's bankrupt. So you better plagiarize. You're not going to get news from anywhere else. In an apology, Amazon.com has offered to redeliver copies of George Orwell novels that were mistakenly deleted from Kindle owners' libraries or provide a gift certificate for $30. Back in July, Amazon received a torrent of criticism, not a BitTorrent, over its decision to delete copies of 1984 and Animal Farm from Kindles after it was discovered that certain versions of those books were added to the e-library by an unauthorized publisher. However, the move to erase lawfully purchased copies of books written about the overreaching hand of a central authoritarian government struck some as funny and others as outrageous. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos apologized for the move in an email to Kindle owners this week. This is an apology for the way we previously handled illegally sold copies of 1984 and other novels on Kindle. Our solution to the problem was stupid, thoughtless, and painfully out of line with our principles, he says. It is wholly self-inflicted. We deserve the criticism we've received. We will use the scar tissue from this painful mistake to help make better decisions going forward. Ones that match our mission. Unquote. Jeff Bezos. Good luck with the scar tissue, babe. Two Missouri state legislators are reeling after the news that two of their colleagues... I don't know how this is written. Two Missouri state legislators, State Senator Jeff Smith and State Representative Steve Brown, have pleaded guilty in federal court to conspiracy to obstruct justice the same day they announced their resignations from office. They admitted to the court that they lied to federal investigators about their involvement in a smear campaign during the 2004 congressional race against Russ Carnahan. Smith pleaded guilty to two counts of conspiracy to obstruct justice. Brown pleaded guilty to one. Outside the courthouse, Smith apologized for his actions. I apologize first and foremost to my constituents. I apologize to my colleagues in the Senate. I apologize to Congressman Russ Carnahan for the conduct described earlier. Most of all, I apologize to my family for not living up to what they expected of me or what I expected of myself. Brown also expressed remorse for his actions. I had a severe error in judgment, and I did something that was wrong, and I'm prepared to accept responsibility for that. I do take full responsibility for my actions. Unquote. Dateline Kuwait City, Jafari Shiites, an Iraqi group, have issued a statement apologizing to Kuwait and to the Kuwaiti government for the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990. From the Never Too Late Department. A top environmental official of the Obama administration issued a statement on Thursday apologizing for past incendiary statements and denying that he ever agreed with a 2004 petition that he signed, calling for congressional hearings into evidence, quote, that suggests high-level government officials may have deliberately allowed the September 11th attacks to occur. Van Jones, the special advisor for green jobs, is a petitioner on that truther, so-called truther movement petition. In a statement issued Thursday evening, Jones said of the petition, I do not agree with this statement, and it certainly does not reflect my views now or ever. He didn't explain how his name got on the petition. He says, also, if I have offended anyone with statements I made in the past, I apologize. Didn't do any good. He resigned at the end of the week. And the conservative Utah Eagle Forum, part of Phyllis Schlafly's organization, and concerned parents are speaking out against an Obama-oriented video shown at Eagle Bay Elementary School in Utah. The video has President Obama asking Americans to pledge to better their lives and the world. It portrays celebrities saying they pledge to support various causes, including conserving water, not using plastic bags, and supporting stem cell research. I think it's outrageous. It's indoctrinating children in a leftist liberal political position, says the president of the Utah Eagle Forum, Gail Ruzica. The video, called I Pledge, with an exclamation point, was shown at an assembly of about 850 children to kick off the school's annual theme of service. Says parent Jennifer Cizowitz, who is a first grader, I'm very upset to say the least. Values are to be taught at the home, not the school. Other conservatives, of course, say values are to be taught in the school. I'm confused. She says her rights as a parent were violated. I should have known in advance and had the opportunity to pull my child out. The principal of the school told district officials she had left it to the PTA board to choose the video. She didn't see the clip. But the principal is writing an apology letter to parents, which will be sent home with students. No formal discipline will be taken against the principal. She acknowledges she made a mistake, says the school board president, and she says she is sorry. The Eagle Bay PTA president says she's shocked I thought the video was inspirational. The parent says she's especially offended at a part of the video where Anthony Kiedis of the band Red Hot Chili Peppers, see, there's a bunch of celebrities who pledge various public service efforts, and she's particularly ticked off at Anthony Kiedis of the band Red Hot Chili Peppers, who says, "I pledge allegiance to the funk, to the United Funk of Funkadelica." The parent says, "It is un-American." The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast, apropos of which, of course, there's a lot of criticism of the upcoming speech by President Obama to students, many schools saying they won't carry the speech, many parents saying they're keeping their children home, and, of course, another big speech coming up for the president this week on health care to the Congress after a rough August. We will find out what's being planned moments from now here on the show.
I wrote with a friend of mine for Georgie Fame. It's called Sweet Georgie Fame. Words and music are all that I need. I will follow wherever they lead. But I'm finding more fun in the game. A darling boy has brought me joy, sweet Georgie Fame. Oh, I heard him one night quite by chance. Now wherever I'm walking, I dance. And London is not quite the same. 'Cause when he sings, the city swings, sweet Georgie Fame. London Bridge is falling down. Pop songs leave me with suspicion. But now at last I'm glad to meet a sweet, loving, real good musician. Oh, from Broadway to Festival Hall, I've listened and I've heard them all. And they say I'm a real swinging dame. Yet I'm impressed, my ears are blessed with Georgie Fame. Make music sweet, you miss your train. My goose is cooked, I'm getting hooked on Georgie Fame.
Right, Rom. What's so damn important you had to get an urgent meeting? I mean, you know, I'm trying to get a handle on a semifinal draft of a healthcare speech.
Yeah, and that's what's so important. We've talked about the drafts, and they're just not there yet. And this one's got to be there. I mean, I just wanted to have a few minutes with you to emphasize that.
Okay. And just sit down and tell me where you think there is. I mean, we agreed we're going to stick a fork in the public option, right?
Mr. President, public schmublic, this isn't about that. This is about you.
Me?
Mm-hmm.
I've got good health care. I'm the president.
This is about you continuing to have good health care by continuing to be the president. This speech is about you taking your presidency back.
I didn't know I lost it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm still shooting hoops in the White House gym.
Yeah, for now. But while you were at the Vineyard, our Republican friends were out at the demolition derby track, and the chassis they were aiming at was yours.
Yeah, we've talked about this. They're the opposition. They somehow think that's their only job is to oppose. I mean, you know, maybe I overstated their interest in bipartisanship.
Maybe. Maybe. When you've got Chuck Grassley sounding like Glenn Beck, there's no maybe about it. I don't want to say I told you so, sir, but from day one, it was clear to some of us that the only Republicans interested in bipartisanship were dead Republicans.
That's their choice. They'll take the heat for being obstructionists. I mean, you know, they're wasting time and energy on opposing my speech to students. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be painfully, humorously obvious by Tuesday evening that the only secret message in that speech is work hard, study hard, and you can be like me.
And for the millions of people who are convinced by the reaps that you're a stealth Marxist fascist dictator on the march, that's a very frightening message.
No.
Look, you've spent August relaxing and eulogizing, and Dave spent August driving your poll numbers down to a normal level. The instant Rushmore days are over.
Okay. And with the healthcare speech, we start reversing that trend. We agree on that.
Yes, sir, but you've got to tell people exactly what you want in this bill and exactly why it's good for them. The drafts I've seen so far have still been a little, I don't want to say squishy.
You do want to say it.
I do, but out of respect, I'm not going to.
All right.
Look, Democrats in Congress have a job approval rating that's lower than Sarah Palin, and she doesn't have a job. Confront them, threaten them. That's what looks like leadership on television.
Yeah, but these are the people we actually have to cut the deal with. Show business bluster doesn't get that done.
Nobody in Congress is afraid of you. I work there, sir. It's a very simple animal. If they don't fear you, they roll you.
All right, look. You know, there were things we absolutely had to be in a hurry to accomplish, right? Keeping the economy from collapsing, mm-hmm. keeping Afghanistan from cratering. Mm-hmm. Then we were in a hurry to get health care passed. That scared some people. I understand that. I want to communicate that. I want to express that now that the moment of urgency is past, that the need for drama has waned, that we can be strong and sensible and patient, and in the fullness of time, with plenty of opportunity for debate and understanding, we can fulfill our responsibilities.
You're kidding, right?
What?
We've got September and October, and then, boom, Congress starts noticing there's an election year coming straight at them, and they can't be afraid of you anymore. They're too busy being afraid of the voters, and we've lost them. Look, I know you hate drama.
Well,
but this is really a dramatic moment. The reaps think they've got you on the ropes. They shook Van Jones loose. They've pushed us away from public option. They're smelling blood, and unlike most of us, they like that smell. Well, Cheney said four words that made people follow him. After 9/11, he said, "The gloves came off." Tell America that the gloves are coming off, sir, and you've got them. This country doesn't like gloves.
Look, I don't hate drama. I just don't think it works. The only reason I picked up that no drama thing was I was watching a lot of NBA hoops on TNT, and they mm-hmm. kept repeating the network slogan, "We know drama," mm-hmm. and Gibbs said, "Ooh, hey." Mm-hmm. Anyway, this speech should fight fear with hope. Hope's my brand. I'm not the fear guy. When I can convince people to have hope, we don't have to be in a hurry. You know, in a way, you know, that's the lesson of New Orleans.
Okay, sir. Let me know when I can pencil over the draft.
You got it.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Yes, now it's time for news from Inspectors General. And, wow, there's a lot this week. Disgraced former financier Bernie Madoff tried by turns to bully and impress the federal examiners who looked into his business. But the investigators managed by themselves to botch the probes and enable Madoff's multi-billion-dollar fraud to continue for nearly two decades, according to the Inspector General of the Securities and Exchange Commission, David Kotz. His 477-page document released just Friday evening of Labor Day weekend, so you shouldn't notice, says the SEC investigations were bungled over 16 years. Disputes among agency inspection staffers over the findings, lack of communication among SEC offices in various cities, repeated failures to act on credible complaints from outsiders that formed a sea of red flags. An inspection of Madoff's operation in 2003-2004 was, quote, put on the back burner, unquote, even though the exam team still had unresolved questions. An SEC official who later would marry Madoff's niece told investigators this year that if he had carefully reviewed a complaint about Madoff's business, he would have investigated more extensively. It's Eric Swanson. A prominent Wall Street figure, Madoff attempted to intimidate and impress examiners, and he dropped names of top SEC officials, says the report. One of the examiners describes him as charismatic and charming, except when he was angry with us. Among the disclosures during an agency investigation in May 2006, Madoff feared he'd been caught. I thought it was the end, he was quoted. He said he felt very fortunate when there was no follow-up call to check on the account number he had given the investigators. They were asking what account he was using to clear certain trades. That narrow escape in 2006, enabled by the securities enforcement staff and neglecting to verify his account, allowed his fraudulent scheme to flourish for another 2.5 years, says the report. It's a failure we continue to regret and one that has led us to reform in many ways, says the new chairman of the commission. Even though the commission caught him in lies, it did not follow up. News of Inspector. That was really it. I thought there was more, but there isn't. But there was more of other news about our friend Pakistan, ladies and gentlemen. The world's most infamous agent of nuclear proliferation, Abdul Qadir Khan, AQ Khan, has added a fresh feather to his cap following revelations that a newspaper column he penned 2 weeks ago for Pakistan's The News heavily plagiarized websites of British universities. Yes, it's not just journalists. It's also nuclear proliferators. He's fondly known to many in Pakistan as the father of the bomb. His newspaper column appears to have been lifted almost verbatim from the computer science homepages of the University of Sussex, Imperial College London, and the University of Cambridge. Reaction on the Pakistani blogosphere has been harsh. Now, also news of him, the Pakistani court on Wednesday suspended an earlier order lifting restrictions on his movements. So he's no longer free, apparently, as of this week. He's free, he's not free, he's free, he's not free, he's free, he's not free. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, the United States Army Corps of Engineers, always in our thoughts. Army Corps of Engineers officials plan to reuse sand in New Jersey, where nearly 2,000 discarded World War I-era munitions were discovered. The Corps says it's taking extra steps to make sure the ordnance is gone before the sand is used to fill beaches on the Long Beach Island community of Harvey Cedars in New Jersey. The munitions were found 3 years ago after the Corps pumped sand from the bottom of the ocean to replenish the beach in Surf City. Surf's up, everybody. And in an effort to meet its 2011 deadline of providing 100-year hurricane protection, the Corps is finding the necessary clay to strengthen nearly 300 miles worth of levees. The problem, says parish leaders in the metro area, is what's left over massive ditches, which the Corps refuses to fill because they say it's not authorized. There has to be a project purpose or need, and we haven't identified either of those, says a spokesperson for the Corps of Engineers. They work for us. One more item from outside the bubble. The active green ingredient found in many insect repellents for more than half a century could be toxic to the central nervous system. That's DEET. It stops the brain from sending messages to the nerves. But fortunately, the good news is they're working on a new insect repellent since they've discovered that mosquitoes aren't attracted to people whose sweat smells particularly fruity. I'm not looking at you. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave. Think of it. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world through the facilities of the internet, on your computer, live and archived at two different addresses whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. On your smartphone through stitcher.com, available as a free download to members at audible.com, and available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. It's the .commies, they're taking over. And it'd be just like the special relationship getting special again. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. Tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Hawaii desks. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and information on music played here on, always available at the ever-expanding harryshearer.com. I can't even say .com since I made that joke, which also contains information on the Unwigged and Unplugged DVD out now. And thanks to Kevin Taylor here at Global Radio London for helping today's broadcast. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from London.